Hi, I'm Stuart Spinks and welcome to episode 288 of my podcast, Beekeeping Short and Sweet. A very belated Happy New Year to you all, and to celebrate the new year, today I'm joined by beekeepers Steve Donohoe and Paul Horton to answer some quickfire questions about their brand new book that's just been published called Healthy Bees, Heavy Hives. Beekeeping Short and Sweet, a beekeeping podcast for the inquisitive beekeeper with a short attention span. A beekeeper, in fact, just like me. Before I get started this week, here's a word about the 2024 Beekeeping Show, who sponsor, in part, this week's podcast.
After last year's huge success, I'm very excited to let you know that tickets for the Beekeeping Show are now available online at www.thebeekeepingshow.co.uk. Join us at the premier Beekeeping Show on Saturday the 24th of February 2024 at Telford International Centre, a convenient central location, free parking and more than 50 exhibitors. We hope to see you there. Tickets at www.thebeekeepingshow.co.uk.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the podcast and a very belated Happy New Year to you. Well, it's been a bit of a drag this Christmas and New Year period for me, having contracted a fairly heavy dose of bronchitis. It's left me feeling pretty poorly and I have to say, not really inclined to get out of my bed. However, I'm back now, recovered almost fully. Got a slight cough, but hopefully we're back to normal now and I can get stuck into more podcasts and videos as we head through into January. So today's podcast, you'll be pleased to know, is another interview, and I'm delighted to be joined by Steve Donohoe and Paul Horton to discuss their new book called Healthy Bees, Heavy Hives, How to Maximise Your Honey Crop, and without wanting to give anything away, let's get straight into that interview. First off, congratulations on the publication of the book, Steve and Paul. I love the title. It is exactly my kind of approach, I think, having had a quick look at the book. The best way to a good crop of honey is obviously having healthy bees. But before we get into the book itself, could you explain how your collaboration for the book came about and perhaps give those people listening who don't know you a little idea about the beekeeping styles that you both have? Steve, do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for inviting me on. Basically, the way the collaboration happened was that I'd heard Paul's name from a number of people in the Bee Farming Association, and they always kind of had this awestruck, you know, wow, he gets a lot of honey, that guy, you know. But I'd never met him or spoken to him. And it, for some reason, I think what happens is it gets to the winter time and I kind of think, God, I've got no bees to do. What am I going to do? And I had this crazy idea of maybe write another book. So I just contacted him out of the blue. And luckily we arranged to have a Zoom chat and we kind of clicked and he was up for it. So That's how the collaboration happened.
Paul, is that how you see it?
Yeah, I mean, it was a surprise to me to sort of have Steve contact me and offer this sort of opportunity. It was never something I thought I'd be able to be part of, really. And it was a real honour to have Steve approach me with it. And I was really keen to sort of take his ideas and work with him on it.
Cool. And the second part of my question, your kind of beekeeping operations, for those people that don't know either of you, how would you describe your setup, maybe Paul first?
So I'm a second generation bee farmer. My father was a bee farmer most of his life. He started in the 60s and I kind of got into the industry that way, although reluctantly. It was not something I was keen on initially, but here I am. And I manage around sort of 250 to 300 hives and I would consider myself a highly migratory bee farmer. So yeah, that's kind of how I run my operation, migrating from crop to crop through the year.
Cool. Steve, how does that compare with your setup?
Completely different, really. I've been beekeeping sort of since about 2012. Started off as a hobby And it started off as an escape from a stressful kind of busy life running a business that has nothing to do with bees or farming. And I'm just the classic person who kept getting more and more hives. And I've got about 70 now, and I've got, I suppose you can't really deny, it's not really a hobby anymore, but it's not anything like many of my friends in the bee farmers. You know, I suppose an American might call it a sideliner.
Sure, yeah.
My particular love in beekeeping is actually the queen side of it.
Right.
So I always wanted to get up to, maybe my goal would be to get up to about 100 colonies, because I think that means that when I'm picking my best queen, she's probably quite a good one.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I having the actual process of doing this book has made me think much more about the way I do things and the honey side of things. And I do have customers, and I do need to make more honey, because at the moment I'm kind of running out before the crop comes in from the spring.
Sure.
So I guess I'll end up about 100 hives.
Yeah. For me personally, 100 always seemed to be that number that I wanted to attain. It kind of almost felt like you'd get a BFA badge, Bee Farmers Association badge, with a little 100 underneath it to indicate that you'd achieved 100 hives. Maybe we should have something like that. Back to the book, though. So I've been very fortunate to have a quick look through prior to publication. Just as an aside, when's the publication date? Has it actually released yet?
I think on Amazon it says today, but
okay.
But I looked just before this started, and I think it was saying temporarily out of stock. So
right,
maybe they're all flying off the shelves
at the weekend. Yeah, maybe I suspect once this podcast goes live, that might well coincide with the book being available. Fingers crossed. So I've gone through the book. It's, I have to say, a fantastic book. I'm saying that completely honestly. I had a good look through it. It's very easy to read. There's so much information in there that we would probably need all of my podcasts for all of this year to be able to talk through all of the topics. So what I've done is kind of gone through it chapter by chapter and tried to pick a question maybe that I can throw at you that you can both have a bash at answering, and that might give people an idea as to kind of information that's in the book. And you know, if there's anything about the book that you specifically want to talk through, then just say. Here's the first one, and the very first chapter. We'll go through it kind of chapter by chapter. You describe in the book beekeeping as a broad church with many preachers and alternative followers of gospels, which kind of is very much my view. I think there are quite a lot of preachers out there, by the way, and beginner beekeepers particularly can sometimes get caught up with that doctrine without maybe digging a bit deeper. But I get the feel that you come at it with a perspective that it's what works for the individual beekeeper, rather than here's a book and if you do what's in this book, you're going to have successful seasons year after year after year. Is that kind of where you're coming from, Steve? Is that your thoughts?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, of the two of us, Paul's the master kind of beekeeper, and I'm more the writer. So I'm trying to capture the essence of what he does. But as you say, and I try and make this clear throughout the book, that this is what works for him. And I also kind of chip in a bit with what I do, but and sometimes we even talk to other beekeepers and find out what they do. But we try and talk about general principles and kind of what's going on and why, and then the specifics of, you know, what the techniques that maybe we follow. But it's not really just a list of techniques. It's more an overall view and trying to get to why we think things happen. But obviously, it's up to you to try, you know, try this and try other things and see what works for you.
Sure. Is that your view, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, there's just so many factors that affect how you keep bees, and it's almost impossible to advise one way, isn't it? And we're just trying to outline that these are the things that work for me and sometimes for Steve, and to take them with a grain of salt and you know, just be aware of your own scenarios and apply them to that, and hopefully they work, but they may not.
Sure.
I think despite the fact that you need to find your own way in beekeeping, there are certain things that are kind of more or less absolute truths in both my opinion and Paul's, which are the ones we cover in the flow chart in the general principles chapter, because you really do need good, healthy bees. You know, you need strong colonies, you do need forage, and you need to be lucky with weather. And if these things don't really change, I mean, if you don't have those things, you'll make less honey. So I think that's important. It's not that every single facet of beekeeping is up for debate. Some things are kind of absolute truths.
Yeah, yeah. You're absolutely right, Steve. There are some things that we all just, I guess, as you become more experienced, you can't almost do it without thinking. And it's for the beginner beekeepers to kind of settle into that routine and then pick up on the nuances of how to get their bees through a season successfully, which kind of brings me on to the second chapter, which is getting bees through the winter. And this is one of those areas that lots of beginner beekeepers struggle with. They feed their bees, they bung fondant on, they over-super, under-super, and do all sorts of stuff. The question that I have for you is, would you say that you follow different approaches to the winter, or is that one of the areas where a winter approach, we all kind of go through the same processes? And what are the kind of processes that you have for working through the winter and bringing your bees out successfully in the spring? Steve, do you want to touch on that first?
Yeah, I think going into winter, we're probably quite similar, and most people would be the same. We kind of feed in the autumn after we've got the honey off, and in Paul's case, he moves hives to wintering sites, whereas for me, the sites are the same, whether it's the summer or the winter. But the basic principle is treat them for varroa mites and feed them up till they're nice and heavy. And then there's not really a whole lot to do. I think we both do an oxalic treatment in the winter when hopefully they're broodless. And then that's it, really. I mean, it's just occasional checks after a storm. But I think it might get a bit different as we get towards spring, because I'm not in any mad rush to move my bees off to pollinate orchards or anything. So I probably do less or do things a little bit later than Paul. So I often don't really look in the hives until kind of early April.
Okay. Paul? Yeah.
I think we're in agreement, really. The majority of the work is actually in the autumn, you know, treating and feeding your bees to get them through winter, and then mostly leaving them alone, to be truthful, barring an oxalic acid treatment or, you know, checking for storm damage or trees down or anything like that. It's that prep work in August, September, October, really, that leads to the success of overwintering your bees. Yeah, and as Steve said, I think we'll probably start to diverge a bit as we get into spring, February, March, April.
And that spring, I guess, very late winter, early spring, the kind of February time, I read in the book, Paul, that you feed fondant with pollen. Is that something that you do as a matter of course with your bees, and kind of what effect does that have on the colony?
Yeah, much of what I do, it's almost for my own peace of mind as much as it is to help the bees. I keep larger number of colonies in my apiaries. I tend to have about 40 on a wintering site, which is mostly to make life easier in spring when I start to migrate bees out. I can pick up everything I want from one spot. But as a result, I do worry sometimes that maybe it reduces too many bees for the amount of forage that's in that area in early spring when there's not a lot about, you know. So it's sort of an insurance policy, feeding them a pollen patty with natural pollen rather than a substitute. But I do think it makes a bit of difference. It certainly gets them brood rearing a little bit earlier, in my opinion. And yeah, it sort of sets them off a bit earlier when there's maybe not so much pollen available in sort of mid to late February.
That's important for you because of the pollination service that you provide?
Yeah, it gets a little bit more brood reared early. Bees are a little bit stronger then come pollination time in April. Really, at that time of year, they need to be a certain size to be adequate to pollinate cherries and apples, say. So sure. It does give them a little bit of a boost. But realistically, I do that in February because when you get into March, there's usually an abundance of willows and prunus available. It's just a slightly early boost is what I think of it as.
And one of the biggest differences in your beekeeping styles that I picked up from the book is that Steve, you're using Langstroth hives, and Paul, you're on single nationals, so a single national brood box to overwinter. That kind of scares me a little bit, having done it years ago, having a single national brood box. More and more people seem to be under supering, adding a super of food because they don't think that their brood box is big enough. Steve, I guess you're perfectly happy with the size of a Langstroth box with the food you can get into it. And how does that feel about your approach, Paul? So, Steve, are you happy with the Langstroth setup that you have without adding extra boxes?
I still sometimes, if a super is kind of not properly capped and there's not much in it, I still stick that underneath the brood box in the autumn and let them bring it up into the brood box. But yeah, I mean, there's plenty of space for my bees in Langstroth, and they can get quite heavy just with stores in the brood frames.
Sure. Paul?
Yeah, I would agree that a national is probably too small for today's more prolific bees. I'd still say it's fine for a more frugal sort of localized bee, perhaps. But it can certainly get close to the mark, I think. I feed quite heavily before winter, but I also supplement with fondant over winter as well. And I think if I took that fondant away, a lot more colonies would be light come spring. So I certainly would agree a national's probably a bit too small. You're safer with a commercial or a Langstroth, something that's got more space for stores, I think.
The National Hive is our most popular hive here in the UK. So for all of those people that are listening to this going, oh, but I've just bought National Hives, they can simply supplement that with the addition of a super or adding fondant, as you say.
There are ways around it for sure, and leaving them an extra super on with some honey in is a very good way of just avoiding that problem. There are ways around it, yeah.
Sure. So that brings us on to early spring. And I'm kind of skipping through these chapters because there is so much information in there that people are going to have to go out and buy the book to get all of this essential information, really. But let's go on to early spring. When is it, and we've touched on this a little bit, when do you first begin your inspections, and what does that inspection entail? So, and Steve's already said that, it's slightly later for him. So if we start with your early inspections, Paul, and then perhaps Steve, you can talk about yours.
So my inspections have to be a little bit earlier due to the pollination work I do, which we often start to move bees in early April to cherries and then mid-April to apples and blueberries. So I really need to get into my hives and assure that they're queen right, they have adequate stores, and they're the correct size to fulfill that pollination need. So most years, I'm depending on weather, it's very much dependent on a nice window of 12 degrees C or higher in March. But usually, mid-March to late March, I have to nip into a hive and make a quick assessment. And it is very quick, less than a minute per hive. It's just is the queen there and laying, like I say, adequate stores and the correct size. And I have notes that I take on this. I have a form that I fill in, a site-based form, and then I can take that form home and figure out, what might need equalizing, what is exactly the correct size, and which bees have issues. And I can figure all that out at home from the safety of my warm home rather than
And
out in the open.
I guess, Steve, at this point, you've still got your feet up and you've got your coffee and cake while Paul's out there inspecting his bees.
Yep, that's
You're not
right.
an early inspector.
Not really, although I sometimes, because I have a lot of Nukes, polystyrene sort, which have the see-through cover, sometimes I pop the lid off and have a sneaky little look just to make sure there's actually living bees in there. But
Yeah.
that's just more for curiosity, really.
And you're kind of. And this, of course, is very weather dependent, but the kind of time frame that you would start inspecting, April time, maybe?
Yeah, I probably, yeah, end of March. It just depends on the weather. Sometimes it can be like mid-April if it's cold, and there's just not really much point.
Yeah, for me personally, this last season, 2023, we didn't start full inspections until the middle of May. It was absolutely ghastly around here. So it is hugely weather dependent. And again, for beginner beekeepers listening, Paul has a specific reason for going into his hives. It's not something that he's advocating that anybody should do just as a matter of course. You mentioned that the inspections were very, very quick. What is it that you're looking for when you have that inspection?
Mostly that the colony is queen, right? And they have adequate stores, and there's adequate brood in the colony that's going to emerge, and the colony is going to grow adequately when they're down in the orchards, essentially. It's just a very quick assessment.
Okay, we've gone through that early spring phase. You fed them fondant. Again, it's something that I do. I think it's more for myself than it is for the bees, to be honest, but we get them through that spring. The next chapter switches to a discussion about equipment and beehives. And this is obviously a really interesting part of the discussion, given that Paul, you're using National Beehives and Steve's using Langstroth's. Given that the modern colony seems to be a lot larger than years gone by, is the National Beehive big enough? Would you ever go to double brood, for instance, or do you manage your bees in that National Beehive so that you're always kind of in control of them?
It's apparent, certainly when colonies are built up, that the queen or the bees are trying to create more space for the queen to lay in single nationals, I think. Often the first super of my hives, they leave a big empty arc where they're expecting the queen to lay. So I
Right.
think the bees are at least looking for a larger brood nest. But I mean, Steve's done some fantastic tables in this, in the book, where we kind of work out the exact space within certain different types of hives, brood space and space for bees. And I think a national is still just about adequate. You get to midsummer, and often you can have 11 frames of brood in some really prolific colonies, or 10 frames and a frame of
Yeah.
pollen. But you're always faced with that problem of then you're left with no stores in that single brood nest, if you have such a prolific queen.
So you're always leaving a box of food with them? Is that
Ideally,
correct?
they're left with something, yeah, or they're at least on a crop that is yielding. You can take a few more risks than if there's nectar coming in, but yeah, ideally they're left with something in at
Sure.
least one super.
And Steve, with the Langstroth, no such worries, I guess.
Not really, but I mean, I'm going back to just briefly what Paul was saying, one thing to bear in mind is that he has very good queens, and when I say very good, I mean not only are they prolific, but they're quite young, and they're not very swarmy. Whereas some people would have the same setup and their bees would immediately be heading for the trees.
Yeah.
So it's not just about the size of the hive, but it's also about the stock that's inside. And the other thing is that I believe Paul's tried going double brood in the past, and maybe for a very, very short window, they use the space for brood and it all looks good, but very quickly that top box just ends up being an extra large super. And given that he's migratory and having to lug these things all over the country,
Yeah.
it's just not worth it for him. But yeah, on the Langstroth, no, it's just as far as I'm concerned, it's the right size for me.
I'm in that Langstroth camp now myself, having tried so many different hives for the videos that I've produced and just trying to demonstrate what's out there. I've ended up going down the Langstroth route just because it seems to work for me personally. And I think that kind of reinforces that point about beekeepers choosing what works for them. So hopefully we haven't upset any national hive users today.
Well, another thing that I say in the book is that beekeepers get very argumentative about all sorts of things, and they argue about types of hive and, whether it should be polystyrene or wood or Langstroth or national. And I don't think the bees really care that much. I think as long as the bees are, they've got a decent sized cavity and they're warm and dry and protected from predators. They make their homes in chimneys and caves and all sorts of places. So I think it's more of a beekeeper issue than a bee thing.
Yeah, Paul, you were going to
Yeah,
jump in.
just to stoke the fire a bit though. If I would start again, I would probably go Langstroth anyway. But National is a nice size for migrating anyway. It's probably one of the easier hives to maneuver about and lift for moving bees. But if you were solely on static sites, I would go Langstroth as well now. So.
And to stoke that fire even further, I'm obviously a very kind of beginner migratory beekeeper. And I'm using Langstroth's, but I'm using only poly hives now. And they've been absolutely fantastic. And certainly coming through the winter, the honey pour poly Langstroth's that we've used, the bees always seem to do far better in those than any of the wooden hives that we've had in the past. But we best leave that fire well alone, because the fan blowing those flames will just go on and on and on. In your book, you've got this fantastic chart showing the season, the months of the year, and where you put the first super on. And it's a really good illustration of where you're working, the time that you're putting that super on. But again, I suspect that it's very much down to your pollination season and not something that you would kind of advocate for everybody to do. But can you talk through that kind of addition of a super? I think it was around April time that you put your first super on.
Yeah, the chart that you're talking about is very much Steve's creation, and it is fantastic. And it's sort of estimating the growth of a colony and when you need to anticipate giving them space. And that is the way I put it. You have to read the bees and nearly be a step ahead of them when you're supering. I think it's if they're literally spewing out the top, there's that many bees, and then you think you're putting a super on, it's nearly too late. You need to be a little bit ahead of them. You need to understand when the brood is going to emerge and how that colony is going to expand, and then how you need to react to that and anticipate that. And Steve's chart is fantastic on that, yeah.
And is there any kind of general advice that you could give to the hobbyist beekeepers? You know, the guys, the lasses that are out there that have got, you know, one or two beehives at the bottom of the garden, but they always seem to encounter issues of swarming, which I'll come on to again in a while. But when should they be thinking about getting that first super on?
It's going to depend on the year, and as we've talked about, each season's different. But you kind of got to look at what forage is available, the size of the colony, and how it's growing. But really, yeah, at some point in April, a colony that's strong enough, you should be thinking of putting a super on. I mean, I'm also of the opinion that you can super too early. You know, a small colony, if given a super above, it's just creating a void of cold then, essentially. So, yeah, it's hard to explain, really, because it's almost becomes instinctual the longer you do this. But, yeah.
Steve, any thoughts?
Well, probably a stating the obvious, but the first super should ideally be drawn comb, because you don't want to sort of put just a super foundation on. But unfortunately, many people who are just starting with bees, that's what they're faced with, really. They don't have the drawn comb. And I think in that case, you probably need to leave it till you're really sure the bees are super strong, so that they can get up there and start drawing comb. But if you've got drawn comb, then, and you've got a good strong colony, then I think it would be, in that scenario, it's better to be a little bit early than a little bit late.
Cool. And while we're talking beehives and equipment, chapter 4, a very simple question for you both. What's your preferred hive tool type? Because I get asked by lots of people, what's the best hive tool? What's your favourite hive? If you could only use one hive tool, what would you choose?
I'm not even sure what it's called. It's like the L-shaped one is the one I use. I'm not even sure what that type is called. But
the standard hive tool.
Standard hive tool, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm very particular, though. I have I bought lots of these many years ago because I found one that I really loved, and it's made of something called sprung steel, and it's got a little bit of flex in it, and it's just brilliant for just cracking supers. And I bought loads of those years ago because I loved it.
Steve?
Mine's very definitely the one they call the J tool. It's kind of got a square end and then a hook at the other end, and I use that hooky piece for pulling frames out all the time.
Moving on, we could talk all afternoon about the next chapter, queens. I'm going to keep this a very simple question for you, because I know, Paul, you're very much into the queens that you use, and people will need to get the book to find out about that in more detail. But if you were looking for a new queen, what are the three traits that you'd be looking for in that queen, and why?
Calmness. For me, when I first started working with my father, his bees were evil, is to put it politely. And now having bees that are just calm and gentle was a massive thing for me. How prolific they are is massive, and low swarming tendency.
When you say prolific, do you mean in
egg laying? Okay. How the queen's egg laying capacity? Because there's a massive difference in that between different types of queen.
Sure. And sorry, what was the
And low swarming tendency is
Low
ideal
swarming
if you can
tendency.
get a queen that's like that.
Sure. And Steve, you breed your own queens? You.
Yeah, I mean, I'm only a sort of, as I said, I've only got a few hives, so I'm not at the scale of the commercial queen producers, but I do my best, and yeah, I sometimes I buy in a breeder queen, such as an instrumentally inseminated one from someone I trust.
Yeah.
But very often I just pick the best of my queens and make daughters off her for as long as I can.
And how would you describe the best of your queens? What traits are you looking at?
Pretty similar to Paul. Yeah, definitely I look at the brood pattern and the amount of brood that she can lay, and definitely temperament and swarming. There's the one other thing I do, which I know is probably futile, but I do mite counts in with an alcohol wash in around about June. I try and kind of find the queen. You know, there's always some queens that have less mites, for whatever reason. And so, if that's a good queen anyway, I might as well breed off her. But I'm not particularly optimistic about that trait sticking into the future.
Right. Chapter six, we're kind of working through the book here, is all about diseases and pests. It's incredibly thorough, I have to say. It's a fantastic chapter and nicely up to date, which, it's very. I mean, looking at the shelf behind the computer here, I've got books going back years and years, and some of them are quite dated now. So it's really nice to have this section that is totally up to date. So, my question on chapter six to you both is, what would you consider to be the biggest threat to our honeybees if you had to choose just one disease and one pest? Paul, do you want to chip
Yeah, without a doubt, it's Varroa, and I actually think it will always probably be Varroa, to be honest. It's not something, although people are working on breeding bees that are more tolerant to it, I think it is something if you want your bees to be in the best possible fettle that they could be in, we have to deal with it ourselves as beekeepers. We have to do something proactively to control Varroa, and I don't think it's ever going to go away. Yeah.
And in terms of diseases, is there a specific disease that you
That's a good
consider a big
question. I mean,
risk?
chronic bee paralysis is becoming a worry, mostly because I don't think we fully know what's going on there. We don't have a treatment for it. We don't even really fully understand what's causing it, I don't think. So that's a really big worry, chronic bee paralysis virus. Yeah.
Steve, your thoughts on
Well,
pests?
in terms of disease, the one that just makes me break out in a sweat is American foul brood. Just be horrific to see any foul brood, really. But if it was American, it would be instant death of colony, and
Yeah.
how long those things can stick around. And yeah, on the pest side, it's definitely Varroa. I even though we've got Asian hornets coming along, I still think Varroa causes the death of more colonies than many people realize. And there are lots of people who think that going treatment free is a good idea, and if they really are managing to do that, then good luck to them. But I have doubts, and I think that Varroa, if you let it run wild in a 2 or 3 years, you're going to have a dead colony, 99 times out of 100.
Yeah. It's a really good chapter because there's so much information in there, yet it doesn't go into too much sciencey talk to kind of confuse and put people off reading it. So again, another fantastic chapter that I recommend to people. The next chapter kind of goes to something far more pleasant, which is all about plants. And the color photos in the book are absolutely brilliant. It's nice to see so many photographs of the different plants that our bees get out and forage on. And again, similar to the last question, and this may well be completely different for the both of you because of the type of beekeepers you are. Can I ask you to pick two plants that are your favorite plants of the season and why they would be your favorite plants? Steve, do you want to go first this time?
Well, it's a strange one because one of my favorite plants, even though I don't think I get much honey off it, is Himalayan balsam, because it comes at the end of the season, and my bees love it, and I think it saves me a lot of sugar syrup in the autumn, because I take the supers off while the balsam's coming in, and they just keep bringing it in. And I think it saved me, it's their winter stores, basically. In terms of taste of honey, my favorite would be heather, but I don't get that. So next time I see Paul, I'm going to try and blag some jars of heather off him, because he does. And I love the stuff, but
sure.
And also I do really like clover honey, although it's not so much of a thing nowadays. But I went to New Zealand a few years ago and had some pure clover honey, and that was absolutely delicious. Really, really like that.
Right. Paul, two plants.
Well, to start, thank you for mentioning the photos, because that was kind of a hobby of mine for the last several years, trying to take pictures of bees on as many flowers as possible. So it was nice that they got included in the book. It kind of justified all those hours spent. But two favourite plants, probably apples, apple trees, apple blossoms. That's a very special, it's the start of the year for me. We get down to the orchards and it's just endless, almost maze-like areas of apple trees, and you can smell the blossom in the air. It's lovely. And similarly, at the end of the season, the heather, when we get up to the heather moors, it's just such a sensory experience getting up there, where you have purple heather as far as the eye can see. And when the bees, if it's yielding nectar and the bees find it, it's just, you can smell it in the air. It's incredible.
The next chapter is all about swarm prevention and control. Incredibly thorough. There's so much detail in there. But one of the questions that comes up that I think is tied in with swarming and swarm prevention and control, and it's usually from beginner beekeepers, is that they have real problems trying to find their queen. And in the spring, they look and look and look, and they can never seem to spot the queen. And they're always asking me what my technique is. So there's the question. How do you find it so easy to spot your queens? And what's the magic trick that you use to get to them so quickly? Who wants to go first? Paul?
Yeah, a technique that helps me is I try and look at the frame as a whole. I think a lot of people try and focus in on a spot and scan and look for a queen, whereas I think if you try and take in the whole frame and then just look for abnormal movements or an abnormal size of the queen or something like that, and just they catch your eye so easy. And I think once you've got your eye in, it does become easier.
It is tricky for beginner beekeepers. It's a bit like spotting eggs, I think, for beginner beekeepers. It can be quite difficult, but once you see them, then you know what you're looking for. Steve, any tips or techniques?
Yeah, and also you kind of know roughly where to expect her. I mean, it doesn't mean she's definitely going to be there, but there's a few frames in the hive that are more likely to have the queen, but you know, the ones with eggs and young brood. But one thing that this question just reminded me of, I think it was last season, I had some particularly yellow or orange bees that I'd never had before. I was setting up a new apiary and I ended up having to buy some queens, which are actually probably more Italian type bee than I would normally have. And just meant that the drones, I've never seen this before, because most of the bees I have are fairly dark. And these drones, they're actually yellow or orange, and they catch your eye when you're looking for a queen. I keep getting distracted by these yellow drones. They're nice bees, but I think for me, because often I have a kind of a browny orange coloured queen, and most of the workers are quite dark, and she stands out quite nicely.
Right.
I find dark queens very difficult.
I think it's fair to say that we all sometimes come up against a queen that just doesn't want to be found, and you spend hours looking for her.
Yeah, well, I worked with Mike Palmer in Vermont a few years ago, and it was the time of the year when they were catching older queens and re-queening hives. It was in July, and he does the shaker box technique when he can't find them, and his guys are just shaking bees through a queen excluder, and the sky is just full of bees. but eventually you do find her, but it's quite disruptive.
Yeah, definitely. So moving on, because I'm very aware that I'm taking up a huge amount of your time. The next chapter is all about migratory beekeeping. Now, again, for a lot of people, this isn't something that they're either doing or ever going to consider doing. But just to give a feel of what that's all about, Paul, if there's a beginner beekeeper that wants to start moving bees around to some various crops that perhaps have been offered, is there a tip that you could give them that would make their task that much easier?
I think being well prepared before you move the bees is sensible. You know, like spend the time, make sure you've got the hive adequately blocked up, ventilated, strapped up securely. You know, prep them before you move them. Don't just show up on an evening and get them all ready and expect it to go right, because it can go wrong. So you can spare yourself a lot of time and heartache by preparing in advance. Yeah, and know where you're going. You know, don't show up blind. That makes such a big difference. You know, at least visit the site once before you drop your bees off, because you could find anything. You know, it might not be adequate place to put the bees. Someone might have come and fly tipped something right in front of where you're about to put your hives or anything. You know, just be well prepared. But to add as well, I feel like anyone could move their bees, even if you've got two hives or 200. I think it's something you should always consider, even if it's just moving them half an hour down the road. It can make a big difference to your honey crop, and don't be afraid of doing it, is what I would advise people.
We should probably have had this conversation summer last year, because I did exactly what you've just described when we took our bees to the heather. I hadn't been to the site prior to going to the heather, and it caused us an awful lot of problems. So You're absolutely spot on with that. Steve, have you ever considered migratory beekeeping?
I have, particularly since I met Paul. It's definitely something that appeals to me, but I need a bigger van or a trailer or something. I haven't got the right equipment at the moment.
I always see it as a bit of an adventure as well. You know, it's like, you go in, I mean, I, from experience, I get to places in the UK that are just such stunning environments that I would have no reason to be if I hadn't taken the bees. And I see some stunning things, and it's kind of as much fun for me as it is taking the bees to a bounty of nectar, hopefully. And, you know,
And the very next chapter in the book is about staying put, staying at a home apiary or a local, perhaps, I'll take Fury close by. So again, a quick question about that chapter. You talk about location and setup in that apiary. Is there a special priority of what you would want to see in an apiary? If you've got a home apiary, say at the bottom of the garden, would you look to set it up in a particular way? Or if you've found an oat apiary, is there a particular location or position of the hives that you would have? Is there something specific that you would always advise people to look for? Who wants to have a bash at that first, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, I'm conscious of the fact that for many people, you don't really get much choice, do you? You kind of, your garden is your garden. And if you find a farmer who lets you have a corner of his field, then they quite often tell you where you can have, and that's kind of it. I wouldn't say I'm an expert on this, but I definitely think getting my van close-ish to the hives is a huge thing, and not just in good weather, but in bad, because that's such a nightmare, having to lug equipment across fields and jump over fences and stuff. It's just hell, really, isn't it? So being able to get the van nearby, and I also look at where the prevailing wind is, and if it's an exposed area and there's like wind charging in, it'd be nice to have kind of a hedge in the way or some trees.
Sure.
And ideally self-facing, just to get the sunshine. But yeah.
Paul, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think as Steve said, even in your garden, you can make sure they're facing the sun, facing south and sheltered. That can make the difference between them getting out on a cleansing flight in winter and not. So little things that can make a big difference, like Steve
said. One of the things that I picked up from the book, again, it was a photograph of some beehives against a building, and the fact that overwintering, they benefit from the warmth.
It that site in particular of mine, it was so obvious that the bricks and the shelter were making such a big difference compared to other sites. And to describe the photo, the hives were tight up to the brick building, and I think, and the building was south facing and it got a lot of sun, and I think the sun and the heat from the sun was hitting the brick wall and sort of radiating behind the hives, and it was almost creating like an artificial poly-like environment, I think.
Right.
It was a fantastic was a fantastic site. I've lost it now, unfortunately.
Moving swiftly on to the next chapter, 11, final chapter, I think, in this, I'm going to say, incredible book, because there is so much information in there. And it's harvesting, processing, and selling honey. Again, so much information in this single chapter for people to glean. But in terms of a question for you both, could you just describe your honey room setup that you both have? Obviously, Paul, you're going to have some fairly commercial setup, but Steve, yours may be something that maybe smaller beekeepers might be able to aspire to.
For me, it's basically a shipping container that's been kind of converted. It's got a sink in there and running water, and I've got power, and everything happens in there, really. I've got AP melter and extractor, and that's it, really, to be honest. Yeah. And I was quite encouraged when I started finding out about Paul, because he's got so many more hives than me. And I was thinking, oh God, he's going to have all this high-tech fancy stuff. And he certainly does have some. Uncapping was one of the things I thought, well, I feel a bit inadequate here because I'm using an uncapping fork. I'm a bit of an amateur, you know. But when you actually look at these ridiculously expensive uncapping machines, half the time you have to use a fork anyway because it doesn't always get all the wax off. So I was quite pleased to see that in Paul's setup, he's still uncapping by hand. But I did get an AP melter on his recommendation, and it's been extremely life-changing. So I'm glad about that.
Yeah, Paul?
Yeah, I always describe my setup as embarrassingly simple because, you know, it's exactly as it was when I first started sort of 10, 11 years ago in my garage at home. It's just a radial extractor and an AP melter and some settling tanks, really. You know, we've improved certain things, but it's remained the same, and it doesn't have to be complicated. Sure, if you're running 500 hives and producing 30, 40 ton of honey, you maybe need to look at automating some things, but up to a point, you can get away with keeping it simple.
And I know the answer to this because I've known you for quite a while, but how do you uncap your frames?
So this was my dad's old method, but we have a hive tool essentially that's filed down to just a very slight curve. And with that, you can very quickly whiz down the frames and uncap quite quickly. And it gives you complete control. And as Steve said, your capping's not always perfect. And some of the machines don't uncap every aspect of it. And still doing it by hand with this filed down hive tool, we can do that and control that.
And very, very roughly, over the course of the season, how many supers would go through that process?
That's a good question. I'm not sure how many supers, because I'm not sure how often we reuse the supers. But I mean, this last year, just over 18 ton gone through that process. So yeah,
each uncapped with a filed down hive tool.
Yeah, it sounds embarrassingly simple.
Well, not at all. And I do think that an awful lot of beekeepers feel that in order to be seen as a, let's say, competent beekeeper, they have to have the very latest equipment, and as long as they're spending thousands of pounds on it, then obviously they're doing the right thing. I have got caught up in that myself sometimes, so you know, I'm not immune to that effect, but it's refreshing to hear that you've such a simple method. And for those of you that are now going to rush out and buy the book, there is a photograph of said hive tool and I guess Paul's hand uncapping one of the frames in the book. So take a look at it. I suspect there might be a rush on standard hive tools and angle grinders to kind of chop them down a little bit. I've got so many questions for you both about the book and also about beekeeping. It's obvious that you both enjoy your beekeeping. It's obvious that you've enjoyed putting this book together because it comes through in the text and it comes through in the way it's all set out. So again, congratulations on producing that book. I'm going to kind of close now because I think we must have been going for an hour or more, and people will probably want to go and get another cup of coffee while they're listening to the podcast. What I'm going to do is put links to the book on the podcast notes. You guys are going to be at the beekeeping show in February. So people will be able to grab you and get autographs and signed copies of the book and the like, I guess. Is that so?
Yep. It'll be the Northern Bee Books stand.
And again, I guess you'll be milling around chatting to other beekeepers and friends all day long. So it's not going to be you're there for 20 minutes and then you're whisked away to another book signing.
No,
Yeah, I mean, the
people
only
come and
thing.
find us and tell us all the things they disagree with in the book.
Paul and I share a similar trait in that we're not exactly extrovert, so we're not, if we seem rude, then it's just we're just shy.
To add one last thing, any of your listeners, if they pick the book up, they can turn to page 77 and see a lovely picture of yourself, Stuart.
I did notice that there was a picture of the old team, the old bee inspector team. I've been telling everybody that I'm an ex-seasonal bee inspector, and now I have proof in a publication. So yeah, it's a lovely picture actually, Paul, just
Nice, isn't it?
as an
We all look
aside.
so happy back then.
Fond memories indeed. On that note, we probably should draw it to a close. Again, thanks for joining me, Steve and Paul, and the very best of luck with the book, which I'm sure will be a huge success.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, that's it for this week. I do hope you've enjoyed this interview. More interviews to follow in the coming weeks and months. But all that remains is to remind you to check out my website, www.norfolk-honey.co.uk, and for my latest videos and podcasts with more updates, tips, and techniques, it's the same Patreon page, www.patreon.com/Norfolk Honey. Remember, I'll pop links to the book in the podcast notes, but for now, I'm Stuart Spinks, and that was Beekeeping, short and sweet.